For the week of December 4th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 346, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you, Michael?
I could be better.
Really? Wow.
We know we're talking about politics before the show, so let's not talk about it too much during the show, though it will come up, of course.
Yes, although when it comes up now, it's funny that you should mention this first, actually. When it comes up now, for some of our listeners, specifically CJ Flynn, we have to start off with the words political spoiler alert. And if you want to know why, well, just stay tuned until the very end of the show and you'll learn why.
Well, I don't know either, so I'm looking forward to that. What else can I look forward to on this show?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll dive into the serious discussions taking place about shortening the window between a movie's theatrical release and its debut in people's homes. With studios like Universal and Warner Brothers involved and serious money on the table, it's only a matter of time before a big move happens. I'm not so sure I actually believe that, but we'll see. Also, the Oscar race is heating up. We cover the latest awards and the year's first big winner. Jimmy Kimmel, that's right. Sometimes confusion and disarray can work to a guy's advantage. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk...
That's how your dating life works, isn't it? Confusion
exactly.
Confusion and disarray, yeah.
That's right. FUD, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. That's right. Michael, you're going to talk about a crazy cat during the book filter segment. And no, I am not talking some beatnik lingo. On Inside Baseball, we'll ask why the major networks are avoiding the Television Critic Association semi-annual get-together and what that means about the health of prime time. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's our main source of information. But we also look at Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, which has a story about one of the big international hits in its newspaper today. And we look at Box Office Profit and Mojo, and everybody agrees. The number one movie around the world is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, another $80 million over the weekend. It passes the $600 million mark worldwide. Let's pause for a second and recognize what an accomplishment this is, because it's not a given that a spinoff from a pamphlet that J.K. Rowling released for charity purposes could be turned into a hit film with none of the characters from the original Harry Potter. It's just the same basic world, but that's how powerful it is. This movie is going to make like about $800 million, just like most of the Harry Potter films. It's the first of five, and I'm sure they couldn't be happier. And it's, you know, really a success story.
Well, of course they couldn't be happier. In fact, we're going to talk later about how Kevin Sugihara, the chairman of Warner Brothers, is indeed talking about how happy they are with Fantastic Beasts and the fact that it is a franchise.
Yeah, and it is a big accomplishment. We kind of take it for granted sometimes when they roll out these Marvel movies or Fantastic Beasts. Oh, of course, it's Harry Potter. It'll be a hit. Not a given.
And now Star Wars, frankly. Star Wars is going to be the same way.
Yeah, yeah. At number two around the world is Moana, a Disney film. And again, they're starting from scratch from a lot of their movies. This is an original film. It's not based on a franchise. It just has the Disney stamp of approval, and people flock to the theater. $60 million over the weekend, $180 million worldwide. This looks like it's going to be another big success story. At number three is the movie the New York Times is talking about. It's called Your Name. We talked about it before. This is a Japanese animated flick about teens who switch their bodies while they're dreaming, I think. And it's a big, big hit. It just opened in China, where it was granted a waiver. Apparently, they'd already reached their quota for the year, but China decided to allow this movie in anyway. It's a massive hit in Japan, where it's the biggest hit of the year and the second highest grossing Japanese film of all time in that country, except for Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away. And boy, is that a masterpiece. So it opened in China. It made $41 million over the weekend. It's at $240 million worldwide. It just did a qualifying run in L.A. for the Oscars, so it's going to be trying to shoot for the best animated film Oscar. This is a big story.
Yeah, I mean, look, $40 million in one weekend in, what is it? Well, I guess it's actually a couple of territories, but most of it was
mostly
from China. Yeah, I mean, that's saying something.
Right, and a huge, huge hit in Japan. And, you know, let's pat ourselves on the back. We have been talking about the worldwide box office for years. right? And I think, unlike most people, even today, whenever we see a new movie, we track it down. We find out what it is. What's this movie in Mexico? What's this movie in Korea? What's this movie in Japan? You know, what's it about? What's the franchise? What's the story? Who are the people behind it? Even if it doesn't open in the U.S., and increasingly more and more of them do, we're interested in that. And you know what? We're seeing more and more people follow suit. They're not following us, but they're following the numbers, because the studios are making the numbers available. And when you share the information, then there's a story to tell. And they're helping to promote these directors. They're helping to promote these movies. And it's better for the business.
Follow the money.
Yeah. And number four is Allied, the Brad Pitt, Marion Cotillard movie. They wish there was more money to follow in this World War II romance. But it did make $20 million over the weekend. And it's at $53 million worldwide and counting. And number five is another addition in the Underworld franchise. It's called Underworld Blood Wars, $16 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on a Wednesday or something in 51 territories. It's at $19 million total. And number six, perhaps an Oscar hopeful, it's Arrival, the Amy Adams film, which is having great legs and getting very good reviews and popping up on some best of the year lists. $12 million over the weekend, $112 million worldwide. At seven is Trolls, which is a film with a song by the two guys who just had their hit show Dear Evan Hansen open on Broadway to rave reviews from everyone except me. I liked it. I just didn't love it. My big problem was the book. But they've got a song on Trolls. They have La La Land, which is opening up on Friday and is a big Oscar hottie, and Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. That is a serious moment in the sun for the two composers. I mean, a Broadway show that's going to be a contender for Best Musical and a movie that's a contender for Best Picture. What a crazy year they are having. But Trolls is a movie they played a small role in. It made $11 million over the weekend, and it passed the $300 million mark.
So what you're saying is they're this year's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And number eight is Sully, the Clint Eastwood film starring Tom Hanks. $11 million over the weekend, and it passed the $200 million mark.
And a little bit of trivia here. Because of the accident or plane crash in Colombia last week, which killed 71 people, including almost the entire team of, it was a football team, yeah. It was a Brazilian football team. But Warner Brothers pulled the plug on the release of Sully in this particular, in Brazil, this year. It might get released next year.
It was scheduled to come out. It hadn't opened there yet.
It was scheduled to be released December 1st. And they, you know, I guess an airline disaster movie right after, you know, a real life airline disaster, probably not a good idea.
It's both sensitive and just good business. I mean, nobody wants to go see that movie right now if you're in that country.
Correct.
And number nine is Tim Burton's film, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Clearly not shaping up to be the franchise they were hoping for with this one. $10 million over the weekend, $270 million worldwide. It's crawling towards tripling its reported budget of $110 million. And given home video and the popularity of slightly more family-friendly films and this sort of young adult novel series that it's based on, we'll probably be okay, right?
Yes.
It's just not a movie you want to rush out and make the sequel to. At number 10 is Doctor Strange, which will get a sequel. $10 million over the weekend, $635 million worldwide. We've sliced and diced these numbers before, but again, this is yet another massively successful launch for Marvel. It's practically their most successful yet, except for Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
Yeah, well, especially it's not a character many people outside the comic book world we're familiar
just like
with.
Iron Man, yeah. Just like Guardians of the Galaxy. So, you know, that's kind of crazy. The Amazing Squirrel Girl cannot be far behind. At number 11 is Swordmaster. This is a Chinese 3D martial arts movie. I think it's a period flick, but I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure if there are fantasy elements either. I tried to learn more about it, but I fell apart. $7 million on its opening weekend, and we don't know the budget. If you do know the budget or you've seen Swordmaster and liked it, let us know. How can they do that?
Well, they can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or they can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And we do read emails and play voicemails at the end of each show during our listener feedback section. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found if you search for Showbiz Sandbox.
And, you know, we love them and read them, even if it doesn't make it on the air for whatever reason, just because of timing. It really helps us to get your feedback. So, you know, please keep sending them in.
By the way, the name of the football team in Brazil was Chapecoense. I couldn't remember the name of it before when talking about Sully. It was Chapecoense.
All right. And number 12 is Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. The latest in the Jack Reacher franchise, I should say movie number two, $6 million over the weekend, $155 million worldwide. Again, they're going to be fine. Who knows what deal Tom Cruise had. But the first one sort of clawed its way to profitability. This one seems to be doing the same thing. So they may not be that eager to make a third one. But Tom Cruise has another big franchise, doesn't he? The guy who just had Mission Impossible, that was his only ongoing franchise. Now he's had this mini franchise with Jack Reacher. And now he's the lead in The Mummy. I didn't realize he was like the lead hero.
Yeah. And of course, there was the big commercial during Sunday Night Football last night. And so everybody saw that and went, what movie is this? And sure enough, it was The Mummy.
I thought he just played a role in it and was sort of like, you know, a character who'd play a part in like the first movie. But he's like the guy.
Yeah.
It's his franchise. Wow. I did not know that.
And I say this because I know we're going to be talking a little bit about what I'm about to say at the end of the show during Inside Baseball. But I was actually at a restaurant last night. With the football game on, the football game was on all the televisions, and this commercial came on with Tom Cruise starring in whatever movie it was. Nobody knew, but slowly, one by one, everybody's head turned to look at the television.
He's still a big star.
Exactly.
Yeah. Skipping down the list to see what new movies have popped onto the charts, we've got Missing at number 16. This is a Korean thriller. It grossed $4 million on its opening weekend. And we've got, where is it? Collide. This is a thriller starring Nicholas Hoult. It was originally going to star Zac Efron, but he begged out and Nicholas Hoult stepped in. And then Relativity collapsed and this movie got caught in the whirlpool of all that. It's finally seen the light of day, at least in one territory, where it grossed $2 million over, probably since a Wednesday, it looks like. But we'll be talking about Relativity a little bit more later in the show, won't we? And then at number 25 is a Turkish film. This is interesting. It's called Gurumce, I think I'm saying it right, which as far as I can find means sight in Turkish. But it's a comedy written by and starring the actress, Gupse Oze. But she has written and starred in this comedy about a girl who lives with a guy and he starts to date someone and she wants to foil the relationship like she always has before because she doesn't want to lose her sweet relationship with, you know, her roomie and the nice safe space she has. So she tries to sabotage that new relationship and things go awry. She seems like a wacky, you know, broad comedy side kind of star. She's making these projects happen. So that's kind of interesting. And it opened to $1.1 million in four territories, including, I assume, Turkey.
And let me guess, in the end, the girl and the guy fall in love.
I don't know if it's that kind of movie. Okay. I don't think it's that, but maybe. You never know. And finally, another new movie. It's called The Earthquake. This is an Armenian film. It opened, I think, maybe in Armenia or Russia. It grossed $1 million. It's about the 1988 natural disaster, and it was put up for the Oscars by Armenia, but it was disqualified because the Oscars say there were too many Russians in the crew working on the film, so it wasn't Armenian enough. It's kind of ironic because at the time of the disaster, Armenia was part of the Soviet Union.
I know. I don't understand how I understand it, but it's also kind of, as you say, ironic.
Yeah, it's certainly ironic. So those are the big movies at the box office.
Well,
one movie that's not on the charts, I should say, pardon me for interrupting, is Florence Foster Jenkins. They announced they were going to re-release it. They wanted to get some attention, maybe get a goose it for the Oscar hopefuls, get it back in people's minds. It's not even mentioned on the charts. Number 40 on the American charts, I should say the North American, is a movie that grossed just $5,000. So I don't know how many screens they put Florence Foster Jenkins on. I know it's playing at the AMC 25 in Times Square, but presumably it just did so poorly they didn't even want to report the grosses.
Wow. So you're talking about a movie that I almost forgot was actually released this year.
Well, that's why they wanted to re-release it. But, you know, when it's already out on demand and may even be on DVD yet, I don't know. But, you know, it's hard to bring a movie out and put it back in theaters. You really got to work hard to get some attention for it and let people know it's there. And the older crowd that is probably the natural fan base for this movie, they're even less on top of things. So they have no idea that it's back in the theater. So, you know, maybe it was a noble effort. And like you say, it's digital, right? So it's not that hard to do.
Correct. But now you actually have a whole bunch of stories that are highlighted here in our movie section. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, certainly we could start with all these awards, but let's stay in movies and movie theaters for just a bit.
Okay.
And let's talk about this story you highlighted about windows. And I'm not talking about the things you look out of. You know, they're not the glass windows that you kind of look outside and see. I'm talking about, the release windows when a movie hits theaters and when it eventually gets to your home on DVD or streaming, and then eventually to cable, and then eventually to pay TV, although less so these days. You have a bunch of stories highlighted here, specifically because CEO Kevin Sugihara, CEO of Warner Brothers, kind of mentioned a few things during a talk he was giving.
Yeah, I saw it a few days ago and thought, whoa, that's interesting. And now it's a bigger story because both Universal and Warner Brothers have confirmed they are having serious discussions with theater owners about shortening the theatrical window. Kevin said that he's having, quote unquote, constructive conversations with exhibitors. And he said, quote, if you start with the consumer, they're telling us very clearly they want it earlier. That's where all the pirating is occurring, right? And so we have to meet that demand with a legal solution. And so, as I've said, we're trying to work with our partners on the exhibition community. So what's going on? Bloomberg reports that the studios are suggesting, at least these two studios are suggesting individually, not together, but that the window be reduced down to 2 weeks or a month after a movie debuts. So if a movie opens in January 1st, it could be available in your home on February 1st.
Yeah.
And they're saying, what price would it be? Will it be a higher price rental or for sale? It could be anywhere from $25 to $50, maybe closer to $50. Theater owners get a cut of the revenue. That obviously is the sticking point. You know, why are they going to agree to this? Because they're going to make money. Otherwise, why would they give up the theatrical? And they all say that Screening Room, which was an earlier attempt to do something like this, but a proprietary one where those people would have the only control, that they say is not a factor.
Well, yeah, no, because Screening Room effectively didn't go anywhere.
Right.
So
nobody cared.
So
you're not convinced that this is going to happen, or at least not anytime soon.
The reality is that what is the difference between, Rogue One, okay, a big science fiction movie, and a science fiction movie that streams on Netflix that hasn't been in movie theaters? One has the cachet of being released theatrically, at least for right now. Maybe over time this will change. But right now, the theatrical release and the ability to be considered for all of the year-end awards is still kind of some cachet. You get cachet from that. It makes it more valuable. It makes the content more valuable than films that stream only.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Nobody's talking about going into homes instead of theater. It's after a movie plays in the theater. And I'm sure it would be flexible in the sense that a big movie with legs like Rogue One is not going to pop up in your home 4 weeks after theatrical because they're still making money. But for all the movies that are basically played out, and it wouldn't happen to a little movie like Hell or High Water where it's showing legs. I think this is about movies that have played out pretty quickly and everybody agrees and says, all right, yeah, it's played out in theaters. Let's throw it into the homes. And I think it would be on a case-by-case basis. There's no way they're going to take Fantastic Beasts and put it in your home 2 weeks after theatrical, at least not anytime soon. I think they're just talking about the movies that are done. You know, three or 4 weeks, it's done. Let's make it available in the home.
Well, okay, that said, I guess maybe this will change over time as whether it's iTunes or Netflix or any one of these streaming services, transactional streaming services, becomes more of a filter, and they become so dominant that all you need to do is go to two or three of them and you're doing your marketing. But part of the reason for doing this is it saves money on marketing both the theatrical release and the home video release. However, if you don't ever know what film is going to move from theaters to home video and you don't know when that's going to happen, you will always be confused as to, wait, is that still in theaters or is it on home? You will always have to go check, where can I see this movie? Can I see it in theaters?
That's always true, right? That's never not true.
Well,
it's,
I think
the fact that you wait 3 months or 6 months to put it out on DVD or Blu-ray or video on demand doesn't mean people then need to find out it's available on, you know.
No, but I mean,
easier or harder because it happens 6 months or 6 weeks after it opens.
No, but movies that were released in summer, I'm no longer looking for in movie theaters right now. I don't have to start at theaters. I can start with, is it on Netflix? Is it on HBO? Can I buy the DVD yet? I can start there. Whereas if it's been 3 weeks since a movie is released, then I'll have to start trying to figure out, well, was it successful? successful, because if it was, then it's still in theaters. But if it wasn't, then I'm going to have to actually go look at home video releases.
Well, letting people know what's available on demand, streaming, on DVD, Blu-ray, that's a constant problem, especially because there's so much out there. What's on Netflix, what's on Amazon, that's just a different issue. And I think the fact that some movies might be in your home a month after they debut or 3 months doesn't change that. Most movies are in your home 12 weeks after they open, right?
Roughly. It's usually about roughly 12 to 16, yeah.
Right. So, okay. So if it's 2 weeks rather than 12 weeks, I don't see how the problem has changed.
Well, it certainly changes for big box or brick and mortar retailers who actually plan their stock further out and allocate room inside their stores for different DVDs.
They'd rather have the movies quicker and sooner. They'd be thrilled to have Arrival in their stores by Christmas.
Well, I can see that.
That's not what's going to happen, but you know.
Yeah, no. Although I would also say that exhibitors don't really settle anymore with movie studios. And that was what settlement means is when you're paying film rental, you might agree up front, okay, I'll give you 50% of the box office for movie X. However, if movie X doesn't perform and is out in 2 weeks, well, then maybe I won't give you 50%. Maybe we will settle and I'll only give you 45 or 40% because, you know, you put it on.
It did so poorly.
Yeah, it did so poorly and it's going to be in the home 2 weeks later.
Yeah. So the studios are saying, hey, look, the movie collapsed. Let's put it in the homes and not wait because maybe we can make money and you'll get a cut of the pie. Isn't that the story? Isn't that what they're saying?
That's really what they're saying. The question is, how real is this and how much of it was just a CEO giving a talk on Wall Street to bankers needing to say something? And he kind of mentioned this kind of in passing. How much of
it
is...
Well, they've been talking about this for years. It's what they want to do. They've had these discussions before, right? This isn't new.
Correct. But I wonder how much of it... I wonder, basically, whether the exhibitors are saying they're having serious conversations with exhibitors. Well, not with us. Who are they talking to?
You know exhibitors, so you find out.
I have been trying to since this was published on Thursday of last week.
It's not just Warner Brothers. It's also Universal.
Well, Universal, let's face it, with Tower Heist, they were the ones that basically said, we're releasing Tower Heist day and date.
That was years ago.
2011.
I'm talking about today.
Yeah. Today they still would like to see the window shrink. Think about it. They're owned by Comcast. So yeah, I think that they would like to see, they are without a doubt far more aggressive than any of the other studios.
Doesn't every studio want to see the window shorten?
Not necessarily, Disney. Disney hasn't been, if you've noticed, they haven't really been saying that a lot lately. And Fox only started saying it recently and Sony hasn't said it at all. So they kind of mentioned it years and years ago, 8 years ago. And they don't talk about it at all anymore.
Why? How would it be a lose for them? If a movie's played out, throw it on video on demand quicker. Don't make people wait.
You know what? I think it would be interesting to see what happens to the market.
The only people who lose are the theaters, which is why you have to offer them a cut.
That's correct.
Right. So there's no downside for the studios, except unless they cannibalize they think they're cannibalizing people and they somehow lose on both ends. Fewer people go to the movies because they think they can wait for it to come on DVD or on demand. And then they don't bother to watch it on demand because it didn't get the attention it deserved when it played in the theater. That's what the exhibitors are constantly talking about, right?
And that's never happened before. Just ask Tower Records. And what I mean by that is if people believe they can get something on Amazon, okay, or through Netflix, soon after it's released, they will just do that. It's cheaper for them, and they won't have to go to the movie theater. Fewer people will go to the movie theater. They will just wait. It will actually socialize not going to the movie theater. And that's exactly what happened with music. When an album was released, it was released day and date, both in record stores and on Amazon, and people just started buying their music on Amazon. Of course, piracy didn't help, but that's another story.
I don't think that follows. I don't think there's some social aspect to buying an album on Tower versus online.
Well, okay, take clothing, for instance. Go ask Sears whether it helps the fact that Amazon has all of the clothing
that's
that they
cheaper.
Sell.
It's not the question. It's just that's because it's cheaper. It's not because they're buying the shirt. They want the shirt. Do they want to pay $40 or $20? A movie is an experience. It's an event. It's very different from just, you just want the shirt. I don't think that's the same thing. A jar of peanut butter, if you can get it for less, you want it for less, of course. But a movie is an event, is an experience, it's something you enjoy. You go out and you do it. It's not something that you just get. You know, it may not even be anything you really want. You don't know yet until you see it. I don't think that quite tracks.
Well, what about music then?
It doesn't track. Again, going to Tower Records is not more of a social experience than getting it sent to you via Amazon. It's just it was cheaper. It was cheaper at the big box stores. It was cheaper at Amazon. They were undercutting themselves, screwing over the retailers who were promoting music most of all, and by offering it cheaper as a loss leader at Best Buy and elsewhere when all they wanted to do was sell fridges. And the record labels knew that, and they tried to stop it, but they couldn't. I think this is like the movie. It's not that selling an album at Tower was the engine driver that led to selling an album on Amazon and led to music being played on streaming services. It's not quite the same thing. But the exhibitors that you're close to argue convincingly, hey, this is where it happens. This is where people learn about your movie. This is where they have fun. This is where they enjoy it. And this is what makes people want to watch a movie when it comes onto streaming on demand. This is how you get attention for it. Don't undercut that too quickly, because suddenly you'll find out nobody's talking about movies anymore.
That's right.
Right. But I don't think there's any less attention for an album because it's available digitally or via Amazon versus Tower Records.
That takes time. That kind of market shift and mind shift takes time.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on.
We could move on to, guess what? More awards for movies.
That's true. We got a big roundup. We got the New York Film Critics, the LA Film Critics, the National Board of Review, and everybody agrees that they can't agree.
That's correct. Yeah. Although this has happened before and it kind of eventually coalesces around a group, and then Spotlight wins. So yeah.
Well, it's a good year. It's a wide open year. There's not one film dominating the conversation. The New York critics picked La La Land. The LA critics picked Moonlight. The National Board of Review picked Manchester by the Sea. And all three films figured prominently on everybody else's ballots via actors, directors, screenplay, runner-up, you name it. So it's a fun year, right? We've got all these movies in the mix. Everybody's enthusiastic about the films. I've seen Moonlight and Manchester. They'll both be on my best of the year list. I'm looking forward to seeing La La Land. It's good for the movies. One thing is clear, though. Studios really don't matter this year.
No, not at all. In fact, I wonder, and I'd have to go back and look, but originally, Moonlight wasn't even rated.
It
didn't receive a rating. So they just released it NR, not rated. So I wonder if they went back and went, well, we better get a rating now. Although they probably don't have to.
It's it was rated, and I couldn't believe it was actually, I'm not even sure why it's an R and not a PG-13. Because I don't recall any particular language. And it's certainly not sexually explicit. It's certainly not violently explicit. I really don't know why it's rated an R.
Yeah, let's see. Release date. I don't know. I don't know if it's rated. I'll be honest.
Then I don't know why it's not rated an R. I mean, it's certainly not a movie that can be unrated. I think if it was rated, it would be a PG-13. There's nothing in this movie. I mean, there's a drug dealer, but there's nothing that you couldn't air on TV in prime time. There's a little bit of language that I just glossed over in my head. It's not violent. It's not, there's not any nudity, I don't believe. I mean, I don't know what's going on here.
Well, and I take it back. It is rated R indeed.
Right. And I think if anything, it should be PG-13.
But I would go back and I'm going to do this for next week. I'm going to go back and find out when it was rated
make these promises, but then you never do.
Oh, I'll make a pseudo promise and try to do it. How about that?
All right. Well, we do have one other clear winner, and that's Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we kind of made a joke about, like, would Jimmy Kimmel one day host the Academy Awards? And by one day, we meant this year.
Who said a joke? Wasn't a joke. The ABC's like, we want Jimmy Kimmel to host the Academy Awards.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You need someone. He's available.
Yeah, and they kind of made the joke for us, or wasn't a joke. They were serious, as you were saying.
Not a joke.
Yes.
No, now he's the host.
Now he's the host. I think he'll do an okay job.
Well, there you go.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so you don't think so, huh?
I don't care.
You don't care?
No.
Yeah, well,
I find him funny. More power to him. He's still on TV late night, whatever. Every time I watch him, I don't laugh, so I have no interest in watching him host the Oscars.
Okay.
He's just not funny, so,
Here's my question. He does this big thing on ABC which is the network that airs the Oscars. He does his big thing every year right after the Oscars. And by the way, his studio is located across the street from the theater. You could literally walk out of the Oscars, okay, from the theater, the Dolby Theater. You could walk out of the Dolby Theater and walk into his studio in probably 90 seconds. You'd have to walk across the street, but still, it's that close. So my question is, will he still do his after show, or will he just have to bag that and hosting the Oscars
and do the after parties? I don't know, because there's a lot of money. You know, it's not a lot of money at stake probably for the after show, but it's a big audience, and he may just want to do both. We'll have to see.
Yeah, well, you know, I certainly don't know how he'd rehearse both. That's for sure.
Well, is there a lot of rehearsing for the after show? Isn't it just more like interviews with people?
Well, it is.
I've never watched it because I don't find him funny.
So what do you really think about Jimmy Kimmel?
I don't think about him.
It's a joke. That part was a joke.
I don't watch any of the late night people. None of them. Well, unless you count Samantha Bee.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess she is late night, right? So
Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, James Corden, I don't care. None of them are interesting. They're not good interviewers. They all suck as interviewers. And that to me is what your job is, to be a good interviewer. I'm not there for stand-up, not there for sketches. I want you to interview celebrities and do a good job of it. And they don't. So I don't watch.
I personally think Stephen Colbert has kind of found his voice since the election. He's kind
of... Well, that took a long time. Maybe I'll check in again.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. I've only watched the monologues. And
that's the last thing. I don't watch that. Yeah. I don't have time for their stupid daily jokes about the Daily News.
Oh, well,
Bob Hope did it 80 years ago and it's dead.
I don't know if it's jokes that Stephen Colbert is saying. He's more like crying on a nightly basis.
And he found his voice, by which you mean the voice he was using for 16 years as Stephen Colbert.
Yes, but now it's more like his true voice rather than him playing a character. It's more kind of what he truly believes.
All right.
Okay, so National Board of Review, can we talk about this for a second? Because I actually heard a distribution executive say that his film is a lock for Best Picture nominee for the Oscars because it won a National Board of Review Top Film Award. And I thought, yeah, I don't necessarily know that that's not the way this works.
No, not at all. And they're just first, right? That's their claim to fame, that they're first.
Yeah, but they're not even like film professionals.
They're not even,
They're not film professionals. They're like, they're all over the place.
Right. And they have no particular pattern of being picks. They, you know, they name the same 10 or 15 movies that most people would name if they were picking the best of the year. You know, there's some obvious ones like La La Land and Moonlight and Patriot's Day, the Mark Wahlberg movie, and Martin Scorsese's Silence and Sully. And you got little smaller films like Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Hail Caesar, Arrival, Hacksaw Ridge. If we name 10 movies, but a fair number of them would pop up on the Oscars as well. And the best film of the year, they said, is Manchester by the Sea, which is certainly an Oscar player. But, you know, all these groups, and then you go to the Globes, they're not really Oscar voters. None of it matters till you get to the guilds. This is all just noise. But it lets people know, hey, here are some of the movies I want to watch. And that helps. And what really matters is when the people who vote on the Oscars vote. So that what matters is the SAG and the producers and the Director Guild and then the Oscar nominations. That's what matters. This is all just distraction. Maybe they're all going to love Hacksaw Ridge. Maybe they're all going to love Silence, the Martin Scorsese movie. Maybe it's too long. We won't know until the votes come in. And the only votes that matter are the people who actually vote on the Oscars. If what you care about is talking about the Oscars, you want to know what the best movies of the year are? Hey, great. The New York critics and the LA critics weighed in and they list a bunch of movies which are all worth checking out.
Well, okay. So some of the movies worth checking out then, you've already mentioned Manchester by the Sea, right?
And did some exec really say, because he's on the National Board of Review list, he's going to be a lock for the Oscar? He can't believe that.
Oh, my
gosh. Or she.
Yeah, in this case, it happened to be a he. And I just thought, not only is that not the way this works, the whole selection process as you just went
there's
through.
There's no track record of that. And there's no track record of the National Board of Review being like, oh, you're going to be in the Oscars because you made the National Board of Review.
Yeah, well, I just also went back and looked at whether that particular film won. So I'm going to narrow it down here. It didn't win L.A. Film Critics. It didn't win New York Film Critics.
It's only three movies. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, frankly, yeah, I don't necessarily see that. That said...
it's better than not being on the list.
Yeah. Certainly, look, you've mentioned Moonlight. You've mentioned... Hell or High Water, you've mentioned Manchester by the Sea. Indeed, these are all great films. So go see them or look at these lists and pick a few, because I don't think you can go wrong.
Well, I don't like all of them, but you know, hey, there you go.
Well, but you do like a certain book this week. In fact, every week you like one book over many of the others that are released, the hundreds of thousands of books that are released each year. Every week, thousands of them are released. And this is my way of moving us along into our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week you pick some top books for us to discuss. What is it this week?
Well, this week there's some obvious picks that Hollywood would pay attention to. There's The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, who is obviously a Hollywood favorite. A lot of his books have been turned into films. This is the least likely project of all of them, and they all have seemed unlikely. But this is about guys working on algorithms, in a sense. So it's sort of people who helped lead to the Moneyball world that we live in today. And it's very unlikely that this will become a film, but you never know.
Well, you know what? Also, but between Moneyball was very tangible. You could actually see baseball, right? But The Big Short, I don't know about that. You know, that was kind of harder to put together. And he wrote that book. And Flash Boys, he wrote that book. So you never know.
You never know. And if Hollywood sees Hidden Figures, which is on the National Board of Review list, that's about the black female mathematicians who helped play a unheralded role in getting us to the moon. That movie looks like it's going to be fun. I really want to see it. I love Janelle Monáe. And if you're saying, hey, give me a project like Hidden Figures, you might look at The Glass Universe by Dava Sobel, which is about other women who were pioneers in science, in this case, astronomy. So that might be a book you want to check out. But my favorite book of the week is Crazy. It's a biography. It's Crazy. George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. And it's by Michael Tisserand. And it's about the cartoonist George Harriman, who created the iconic comic strip Crazy Cat. And this is obviously one of the best comic strips of all time. And it's often at the top of the list, ahead of Peanuts, ahead of Doonesbury, ahead of any comic strip you can name. You'll often find this at the top. It's a great, great comic strip, hugely popular in its day among the cognoscenti. And there's a lot about George Harriman that's really interesting. This book captures the life of journalists and comic strip people in the early 1900s. He was a black person passing for white most of his life. That came out in the 70s. And this book really ties that in well into the strip that he created. So it's just a really good biography about one of the great artists of the 20th century. If you don't know Crazy Cat, please, dear God, check it out. And if you want to learn more about his life, check out this biography.
Well, we should point out to our listeners that Crazy Cat is spelled both with K's.
Yes, that's right. Crazy Cat. Well, K-R-A-Z-Y-K-A-T.
So in other words, you know, even though we might not know who George Harriman is now, back in the day, he was a big deal.
That's correct. I got it. Keep going.
Okay. Well, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story: DirecTV Now finally launched, and it looks like over-the-top pay TV is very, very close to the reality of a full-service package that seriously undercuts cable. DirecTV Now, I love the fact that nobody could come up with like an original name for their streaming service. DirecTV Now offers an array of packages, and some argue it's a loss leader intended to smooth approval for a merger, but it does offer 60-plus channels for $35, including all the major networks except CBS and Showtime, at least in the future. You know, maybe they'll get it. Sign up now and you can get 100-plus channels for $35, plus HBO for an extra $5, and it's guaranteed forever. In other words, that's all you'll pay for those 100 channels. You can only watch on two devices at a time, and there won't be a DVR function until 2017 sometime. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal.
What?
No, I mean, do you agree? You know, it's like they're not there yet. You still can't say, all right, I just want this instead of cable or satellite. It's just not there yet. You don't have CBS. I'm sorry. You got to have the major networks. You got to have ESPN. You got to have all the big obvious channels that people want. It's not quite there yet. They're missing the most popular number one rated network. So that's a big miss.
Well, and also all the sports. All the sports not there.
Right. They don't have any sports? No ESPN? Nothing?
I don't think they have ESPN. I could be wrong.
Well, there you go. Then they're even farther away. So, you know, they're getting darn, darn close.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. It's pretty much, you know, linear television, and these cable packages are kind of dead at this point.
Well, dead. It'll be years before they're dead, right?
Well, I mean, but yeah, I think that it used to be that the cable providers or the networks didn't want to upset the cable providers, right? So they would never just, you know, sell direct or break up the bundle. Now it looks like nobody cares. None of the networks care. They're willing to do it.
Here comes your big Wi-Fi bill, your internet connection bill. Boy, is that going to get big.
Welcome to, ISP caps. And by the way, it looks like they might actually indeed have...
They do offer ESPN and HGTV and CNN, so they do.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's it. I've got to go so that I can sign up for DirecTV now. And they have Guy Fieri. And if you don't know who Guy Fieri is because you're from, you know, another country, look him up and don't make any of his recipes. Okay, so that's DirecTV now. In a related... you know what?
You can jump to it right now.
Okay, yeah, let's jump to it right now. Netflix has finally added an option their subscribers have been begging for: downloading. Now you can choose to download select TV shows onto your phone or tablet and watch them offline. Netflix originals and other shows like The Office are among the ones offered immediately, allowing people to keep watching on an airplane and a train or an automobile, anything that moves, as well as any other place where they don't have an internet connection. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for Netflix subscribers, right? It's a massively desired service, and now they got it. I don't know how it works. I guess it expires at some point when you connect to the internet again, or I don't know how they do it, but I'm sure it's straightforward. And assuming it works well, good for them.
Yeah, it's tied to the device. It's basically keyed to that device. So if that file were to leave that device, it wouldn't work.
And, you know, once you control your programming, you know, that's what they're saying. They can't do it with everybody else's program, but with all of theirs, they can offer it. And they've got enough now that it means something. You know, when they had four shows, nobody would have cared. But now they've got, you know, like 1,000 hours of programming and they keep adding more new shows, it actually means something.
That's right.
So, you know, there you go.
Political spoiler alert. Okay. Hollywood expected to play a role in the new administration. They just expected it to be the Clinton administration. Instead, President-elect Donald Trump has tapped Hollywood producer Steven Mnuchin to be his Treasury Secretary, and the press has made much of his movie connections. First, Mnuchin followed his dad to Goldman Sachs, just another trust fund baby with a crazy dream that led to an estimated $40 million personal net worth. Then he
done.
Yes, very good. Then he formed a hedge fund that invested in two Trump projects and was even, and this is actually a badge of honor, he was sued by Trump before settling. That led to snapping up a failed bank brought down by predatory mortgage lending practices. That reportedly continued, by the way, the predatory mortgage lending practices, with the renamed One West foreclosing on homes at an extraordinary rate, questioned by the state of California, among others. Still, it almost doubled in value, that is the bank, before being sold again. Mnuchin was co-chair of Relativity, but jumped ship before it went bankrupt. Some of his Hollywood successes include involvement in backing the X-Men franchise and Avatar, as well as the most recent Mad Max. His best pals in Hollywood include Brett Ratner, and when Mnuchin was asked by Bloomberg Businessweek why he was backing Trump, Mnuchin actually said this. He said, quote, "Nobody's going to be like, well, why did he do this if I end up in the administration?" Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It seems like he's got more of a history in financial world than Hollywood.
Yeah.
But his name is on 14 movies released in 2016 alone. And there's some big movies like Sully and Suicide Squad and so on. So he's definitely, you know, got money in Hollywood. Can you judge someone by their friends? Well, one of his best friends is Brett Ratner. What does that tell you? I don't know.
Well, you'd have to know Brett Ratner for that to make any sense.
Well, and I'm sure people in Hollywood do.
And if you're still listening to us and you dipped back in to see if we've gone past the political spoilers, we haven't. Fast forward another like 2 minutes. President-elect Donald Trump now has three advisors on his transition team overseeing his FCC telecommunications agenda. All three of them are opposed to net neutrality. I can't believe this is coming up again. The latest comes from, comes from the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank seen as neoconservative and featuring a who's who from the George W. Bush administration. Their politics aren't as neat as that, or at least that's what they insist. But the other two advisors served as lobbyists for Sprint and Verizon. So is net neutrality doomed, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal, right? Business wants to know what's happening. They want it to be consistent. Whether you have net neutrality or you don't have net neutrality, the worst thing is to just not know. That's the biggest problem. Obviously, you and I support net neutrality because it's good for the internet and good for the world. And it's good for business, frankly, though some businesses are too dumb to know that. But this is a big issue, right?
It is a big issue. And I would say after everybody woke up maybe day one or two and kind of got over the shock of the election and kind of, you know, their hangovers were gone, this was one of the first issues along with climate and the and healthcare.
Well, that was Hollywood. Hollywood's talked about this.
Yes. Well, yes, of course. Yeah.
And the tech industry.
I was going to say the tech industry more so than Hollywood. But the net neutrality issues were raised like day two or three. Like, oh, wait, what's going to happen to the FCC? Well, I guess time will tell. As you said, nobody knows. That to me is the bigger deal.
Well, we do know who his advisors are. And so we can see the people he puts in place. You know, he can say I'm protecting Medicare. But if you pick someone to run oversee that hates Medicare, it's a pretty good chance good things are not going to happen.
That's true.
So, I mean, it's a good bet that whoever they put in the FCC is not going to be a friend to net neutrality. You don't have to worry about a tweet or what people say. You know, what are they doing? They're putting people in place who are anti this proposal. And if you think that's a good thing to have net neutrality, that's in danger.
MTV has dumped its head of original programming after just 6 months. That's no surprise since the boss who hired him was also fired recently. Michael Klein obviously didn't have a chance to succeed or fail in such a short amount of time, but it still adds to the turmoil of a channel that is still trying to figure out what it is in a world of on-demand videos and free music. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, I guess at one point they realized they were just a reality channel and now they wanted to change back to music, but that process is stumbling because nobody's in charge right now. So they got to get new people in there, figure out who they are and make it work. But it's still a valuable brand. You just don't like to see it flounder for a couple years.
Yeah, it needs to redefine itself. I agree. Director Bernardo Bertolucci confessed in a newly surfaced interview from 2013 that a simulated rape scene in the groundbreaking movie Last Tango in Paris was in fact more than just acting. The late star Maria Schneider didn't know what Bertolucci and the star Marlon Brando had planned and didn't know Brando would use butter to humiliate her while simulating the rape they had planned from the start. They did not have sex for the film. It was all simulated, as was the rape scene. Nonetheless, Schneider later said she felt, quote, a little raped. She never spoke to Bertolucci again after the movie was done, and he admits she hated him for the rest of her life. Bertolucci admitted he felt bad about the humiliating idea of grabbing butter and making Schneider feel violated, but didn't regret shooting the scene, which means he didn't feel that bad. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. How does this make you think about the movie, of course, is different. It's still a little unclear whether when he's saying that Brando like sort of assaulted her, he took the butter and actually, you know, rubbed it on her vagina. Is that what happened to sort of, you know, because one thing is clear. He didn't rape her. People are treating this as if Bertolucci confessed that Brando raped Maria Schneider. That's not what he was saying. He's tried to clarify that again. The sex was simulated in the movie, even though people wanted to think it was actually happening. They didn't actually have sex. And he says the other two people are dead. No. He didn't rape her. He did not penetrate her. That doesn't mean he didn't humiliate her and assault her if he took butter and rubbed it on her vagina. We don't know exactly what happened, but we do know she wasn't expecting anything to be done with butter. She wasn't told about it. And the intention was to humiliate her. And so that obviously is ugly and unpleasant and certainly nothing to be proud of. That's not how you make a movie. And so people are right to condemn that, but they are acting as if he said, I raped her. No. They didn't say Brando raped her. They just said they did this humiliating thing because they wanted her reaction on camera, which is ugly and unpleasant. I mean, you heard a story about Dustin Hoffman in a new biography of Meryl Streep, how he slapped her off camera during the making of Kramer versus Kramer because he wanted to get a reaction out of her. And she's like, she was probably like, I know how to act. You don't need to hit me.
Right.
And so they did not get along well in that film. That's just absolutely uncalled for. That's not acceptable whatsoever. But of course, he was a star and she was just a newcomer. So that's awful. And whatever happened here sounds awful. He says it was awful. But let's not conflate that with rape. Not because humiliating someone to get a reaction on camera isn't bad. It's just not the same as rape. But Bertolucci still is unclear. Did he take butter and physically assault her with it? I don't know. Well, I don't know what happened. He keeps going, well, no, we didn't rape her. It's like, well, what'd you do? But
and,
it's
and
ugly,
this was
it's
a film, if you haven't seen Last Tango in Paris, none of this makes sense, but it's, you know. And
well, there's a rape scene in the movie, and he uses butter as a lubricant, and that's in the film. They always planned to simulate a rape scene. They did not actually have sex, nor did they physically rape her. That's always been clear. That's what they've all always said. But there was humiliation done during the making of this scene in order to get a reaction from her on camera. That's uncalled for, and it shouldn't have happened. It now, certainly would make you more uncomfortable watching the scene if you saw the movie again today. I don't love the movie.
Okay, now you mentioned Dustin Hoffman and the lengths that he will go to in a scene and on a film. And there's an old story about Dustin Hoffman staying awake for like 48 hours to film a scene in Marathon Man. And he shows up on set and he's with Laurence Olivier, who's playing the torturous dentist. And Laurence Olivier says, you look horrible. What happened to you? And he says, Hoffman says, I've been up for 2 days and I've been running around. I've been trying to, you know, get ready for the scene and I wanted it to appear real. So I stayed up for 48 hours and, you know, now I'm all manic, just like I need to be for the character. And Laurence Olivier says, it's called acting. You should try it. Okay, well, Matt Lauer of the Today Show has extended his contract for 2 more years at $20 million per year, to which Billy Bush is saying he was making how much? Anyway, Lauer collapsed in prime time when he held a widely criticized forum with the, well, then presidential candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So this vote of confidence is welcome. But his main job is firing on all cylinders. Today is beating its rival Good Morning America in the key demos. You know, that at least the ones that advertisers covet, though Good Morning America is still on top in total viewers and both shows are down overall. Lauer has co-hosted Today since 1994 and will be there through at least 2018. His co-host Savannah Guthrie has also extended her contract and Guthrie's extracurricular activities are doing better. She's the main fill-in host for the evening NBC World News and has done well on Meet the Press. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because Today is responsible for 22 hours of TV on NBC. It is a cash cow. It is a monster property, hugely profitable, hugely important. I just question how this all came about because Lauer's contract was announced loudly. Hey, signed for 2 more years. And yet Savannah Guthrie, though women are the key audience in morning programs like this, her contract was quietly renegotiated a few weeks ago, and they're just mentioning it now. It seemed to be like her people got the word out after his made such a splash. They wanted to say, oh, by the way, she re-upped too. Why would it be quiet for either of them? Why would her re-upping not be just as big news? Sexism at play yet again.
Or, you know, she may have asked for it. I don't know, actually, because they did eventually come out. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, it seems like a double standard yet again. He's been the face of the show longer, but she's awfully important. Women are key to the success of today's show, and she's doing a good job, and she wants the same attention. She's certainly not making as much money as he is.
Well, last week you kind of mentioned that the story of how Donald Trump and the cast of Hamilton got into a bit of a tiff via...
Contratemp.
Yeah. Well, I guess the whole boycott of Hamilton isn't going so well, because... Many
nobody called for a boycott, really?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Not really. No.
He
used the word. Whatever.
No,
nobody's trying to boycott Hamilton.
Well, no, that's not true. He didn't call for it. However, there was on social media a call to boycott.
You're giving credence to something that somebody posted a tweet. I don't think that should count as a call for boycott. You know,
it was
some
trending
guy somewhere
on both Facebook and Twitter. It was a trending topic. So,
whatever.
That's well, stupid. Whatever the case may be with the, you know, who called for the boycott, whatever, it doesn't matter. Many of the original leads have left. And that leaves little doubt that Hamilton is bigger than the breakout talent that made it famous, even creator Lin-Manuel Miranda. It hasn't missed a beat at the box office, even with this social media boycott shenanigans. And in fact, became the first Broadway show to gross more than $3 million in 1 week with just 8 performances. It helps that the top ticket price pretty much doubled to $1,000. It made $3.2 million, about $750,000 more than the number two show, The Lion King. It came during a record haul of $35 million for Broadway as a whole during a recent week. $35 million in 1 week. That's a lot. The period between Thanksgiving and New Year is always Broadway's biggest season. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. I mean, they doubled their ticket price. They set a record gross. They are on fire. Broadway is on fire. They just got a new show that opened to rave reviews. It's a good couple weeks for Broadway. Always the period between Thanksgiving and Christmas is salad days for Broadway. Everybody wants to see a Broadway show, and every show grosses money hand over fist. We had four shows in the $2 million club, including Hamilton, which made more than $3 million. We got 13 or 15 shows in the $1 million club, depending if you count some people just, you know, a smidgen under that. So that is pretty great, especially if you assume, as we are, that there's no show with probably operating costs much more than $750,000. So you're looking at, you know, 15 shows that all made serious profits, and certainly some even below that. Oh, and one more thing. Wicked, which I just saw for the first time, became the ninth longest running show in Broadway history. That happened yesterday, December 4th. We're recording on Monday. And it passed Beauty and the Beast. It opened in 2003, and it's had more than 5,400 performances.
So let's stick with Broadway for a second. The smash Broadway musical Jersey Boys is calling it quits in January after 12 years on Broadway and touring editions all over the world. It has made everyone involved a ton of money. Cue the lawsuits. That's what that means. One acknowledged source of the show's book is an unpublished memoir by Tommy DeVito that he handed to the creative team. That manuscript was written in collaboration with a Texas attorney, which DeVito reached out to for help, thinking his eighth grade education probably wasn't enough to do the story justice. They worked together, but the lawyer died of cancer before it could be sold. His widow found out DeVito had copyrighted the book without including the attorney. She sued to stake her claim in the work and now is suing Jersey Boys and its creators for profiting from the work without forking over money. A jury in Nevada agreed that some 10% of the show could be attributed to this unpublished book. That's 10% of hundreds of millions in profits, by the way, and counting. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big whoop, right? It's people suing other people to make some money. I don't think it breaks any ground legally. But it's certainly be interesting to see what happens to it all. And it's, you know, it happens all the time. Look at Buckaroo Banzai. Did you ever see that movie? The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
Everywhere you go, there you are, or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
Now that is a genuine cult film, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I saw that movie in movie theaters. Okay. When that movie was released in the '80s.
So did I. And I liked it. It's nutty. John Lithgow has a great performance in it. Peter Weller is really fun. And it was a flop, but it has a cult following. And now all these years later, they're trying to turn it into a TV series. And the director and screenwriter of the movie have stepped forward and said, whoa. Because they had gone around with this whole pitch for Buckaroo Banzai as a franchise. And they had like multiple stories mapped out. And when they went to the studios, they said, hey, look at all these different great stories. And the studio that made this movie specifically chose only one story that they wanted to get the rights to. They did not pay for any of the other rights to any of the other ideas. And so these guys are now saying, hey, look, you had your chance back then and you chose not to. Of course, that wouldn't happen today. You would always secure all the rights. And they're saying, look, we have the rights to this movie and other properties and other ways and other storylines. All you have rights to is the one story you told in the movie that you told it. So they're all going to court. They've been telling other like Netflix and Amazon, don't do a deal with them. We've got the rights to this movie. So everyone's suing everyone. We'll have to see where it ends up. But it's kind of interesting because of the way they did have multiple storylines mapped out. And they said, hey, do you want the rights to all these? And they said, we'll take number three.
Well, do you remember the name of the character that Christopher Lloyd played in Buckaroo Banzai?
I remember John Lithgow said, laugh while you can, monkey boy. But no, I don't recall what the name of the Christopher Lloyd character was.
John Big Boutte.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a silly movie.
It's a silly movie, but it's definitely a cult hit and, you know, worth checking out.
It's not really a good movie, but it's fun. You know what I mean? You know, it's goofy fun.
That's right. Well, now, another film that I actually saw in movie theaters was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Do you remember this movie?
Like Jimmy Kimmel, I chose not to see it.
Okay, well, the reason I mention that is it has, well, I guess it has something to do with the Beatles, but not much. It has to do with the Bee Gees. And in a huge announcement, the famed music label Capitol Records announced its newest signing is indeed the Bee Gees. But here's my question. Has anyone actually told them that most of the Bee Gees are, how do I put this? Well, they're unavailable would be one way of putting it. Dead would be another. Well, I guess, yes, they, you know, Capitol Records knows, but the catalog of studio albums from the Bee Gees and their greatest hits compilations, not to mention the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever and that movie I was just talking about, is one of the most valuable in history. It has also languished in recent years with nowhere near the attention lavished on, say, ABBA or Queen. Capitol and Barry Gibb intend to change that with various elaborate plans to revitalize interest in the band and their music in the years to come. Step one was Capitol acquiring the rights to the Bee Gees' entire recorded history. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal as we see publishing rights and the recorded rights of artists like Prince and the Bee Gees and how valuable they are and how they can be exploited long after those artists are gone, which is why copyright is so important and why that needs to change. And in this case, what's step two? I'll bet it's a Broadway show of some sort.
Staying alive.
Well, no, not based on Saturday Night Fever, but based on the Bee Gees or an original story like ABBA. No, I don't think it's about redoing Saturday Night Live. They've tried that. It didn't work. I think it's about, you know, taking all the music of the Bee Gees and telling some new story around that.
No, that could work. Maybe. We'll see.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a good creative idea. I'm just saying that's what they're going to do.
European TV. Well, they have a problem. And that is American police procedurals, a la Law & Order and CSI and NCIS, all those kind of procedurals, they remain hugely popular throughout Europe, but the American networks simply aren't making enough of them anymore. So NBC Universal has partnered with French and German TV networks to make them anyway. First up is Gone, a procedural starring Chris Noth as the FBI agent who rescues a victim of child abduction and then partners with the young man years later to head a task force focused on such cases. NBC Universal is putting up a third of the money for the 12-episode order, along with France's TF1 and Germany's RTL. Since no one else is making these types of shows, they'll make it themselves. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I think it's just fascinating, don't you?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that police procedurals are popular in both Germany and France, because when you visit those countries and you actually watch television,
turn on the TV. Yeah.
It's like it's one episode of CSI and one episode of Law and Order after another. But of course, they're all dubbed. And so it's a lot of fun trying to figure out, like, yeah, well, which episode is this? And what are they talking about? You can actually maybe learn French or German by watching these shows.
But how fascinating that I'm sure they are making their own original procedurals, but instead of doing another one, they're spending money to make an American procedural. That's what's kind of fascinating to me. But Chris Noth, obviously a big star, thanks to he was on Law and Order, right? As well as Sex and the City.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that to me is kind of the really interesting thing. And they're saying, hey, we want this all over the world. And yet it's another example of how so much money is being made all over the world by these TV shows, and we don't hear about it at all.
Well, and I would like to point out, it's another example of how a production source can be seen as cachet. So here, an American procedural is kind of value, so to speak.
Yeah,
a big
international star.
Right. And much like, as you pointed out and I pointed out, being released in movie theaters has some cachet to it.
Oh, absolutely. It's very important. I don't mean to downplay that at all.
Yeah. The Lyric Theater, a mammoth barn of a Broadway house that seats 1,900 people and was home to the troubled Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark musical, is closing for renovations. The sudden announcement that the space would be closing down next May means its current occupant will need a new home. I wonder how they found out. That show is Cirque du Soleil's first attempt at an actual Broadway musical called Paramore. They insist they're already talking about transferring the show, despite the fact that 40% of its seats are empty, even during the height of the holiday season.
I mean, I never would have thought this show would even be open come next May. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I'm sure that they're, you know, they probably won't be, but, you know, they have to put up a good face on it, right?
Yeah.
Now, you might ask, why is the Lyric doing renovations after it had a chance to spruce up before Paramore showed up? In fact, they had months and months and months to kind of spruce up the place, right? I mean, what's the deal?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take long to get the answer. They're radically reshaping the space and cutting down the seats to 1,500. That's 400 seats gone. And they're in talks with the London producers of a small little play that hopes it will have legs.
I hate that.
Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. That's right. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal. This is just a barn of a theater. Nobody really likes it. It's awful to play in. And I think, though it's being done for Harry Potter, I think it's going to be a permanent. I mean, they're spending like $20 million to renovate the place. I think they're going to leave it at 1,500 seats. They're moving the back wall forward. They're doing everything they can to make sure that it's a better space for a lot of different types of shows. And I think it's the right decision to do. One other reason Harry Potter wanted to be there, it's got a big lobby and tons of restrooms because it's a newer theater. And this is a two-part play that people will sometimes go see matinee and evening. It's a long day at the theater. People can be milling about in the lobby a long time. And a lot of shows have a very, very tiny space in the lobby. So it's nice that it has an actually really capacious one because they're going to have big crowds and lots of kids and everyone's going to need to use the bathroom. So I think those are all smart reasons why they're doing this. They're going to pay Paramore to leave early, apparently. So they're spending a lot of money. It's like $40 million to renovate the space and get Harry Potter in there. And that's going to take a long time to earn it back. But I think it's just going to make the theater a better space long term.
Well, think about it. Remember when Spider-Man was in there and it cost $70 million and everybody thought, there's no way this show will ever make its money back. Well, you're practically halfway there. You're more than halfway there at $40 million.
No, this is the theater owners themselves spending $40 million just to make their place available to Harry Potter. That's not part of the Harry Potter budget.
Okay, well, I guess if it winds up making $2 million,
They're spending tens of millions of dollars just to say, please come to our theater. Every house on Broadway wanted Harry Potter. They see it as a guaranteed 2, 3, 4, 5 year runner, which is, crazy. That means it's one of the longest running shows in history, but that's the kind of hit it is. I'm sure everybody bent over backwards to accommodate Hamilton, but this is extraordinary. $40 million to kick out a tenant who I thought they could have kicked out anyway, frankly, and $40 million to renovate your space and take out 400 seats. They basically said, look, this is a disastrous location. It's a disastrous space. Nobody likes it. It doesn't work for anything. We need to change it up. And I think it's a good long-term investment. And if Harry Potter runs for 3 years, I guess they'll make their money back and be profitable.
And that would be a big deal if it ran that long. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
That's right. And this week is about the TCA, the Television Critics Association, and their semi-annual get-together. Sperling, what's this about?
So it looks like what happens at the TCAs is a whole bunch of journalists get together and they, for days on end at a hotel in Pasadena, will sit there and interview all of the executives and all of the stars of the various shows. So in the summer, when they do it, it's for the new fall season. So they'll talk to all the stars and the executives behind the fall shows. And likewise, in the winter, it's for the mid-season replacements.
Well, and it's not just a press junket, right? I mean, they actually see the shows, right? Or at least reels and things.
Yeah, they'll see like one or two episodes, yes, beforehand. Okay. So that they can ask questions as opposed to, so you're an actress and what's your show about? And yeah, I haven't seen it yet. Tell it. It's more that they've seen one or two episodes. They then go and they talk to them. And these things are weeks long. Sometimes they're like 2 weeks long. And it's just a grueling slog if you're a journalist. And I think actually now the networks don't like it either because they're not going. They decided, yeah, you can do that. We won't be there, but you can come and ask questions to nobody if you'd like.
Well, Amazon and Netflix are skipping the winter tour entirely. And of course, they're on a different schedule than the rest of the world. They play a different game. But the big four networks apparently are all keeping their executives away as well. They're still attending and pitching their shows and want things to happen. They're just not putting their executives on what are known as panels. Basically, the executive ABC and CBS and NBC and Fox and the CW, they all get up on stage one at a time and the journalists barrage them with questions. They have to defend their schedule. They have to defend their network. They have to defend what progress they're making on diversity. They have to sort of, face people. It's like a press conference and they got to answer a lot of tough questions, and they're available twice a year to a lot of journalists who otherwise couldn't get them on the phone because we're looking at journalists from all over the country. We know the Times and Variety and Hollywood Reporter, they can get these guys on the phone, but you're from Oklahoma, you're from Missouri, you're from Georgia, Florida, you're not picking up the phone and getting the head of ABC on the phone, right?
Correct. Now, you might recall, Michael, when I said that, network television, linear television, they're in trouble. They kind of have a cancer. They seem to be on their way to obsolescence, whatever that word might be. They're not going to be around, at least the way they are, for very long. And I think Tim Goodman actually said the same thing. They're scared. And so rather than put executives up who may not know what the future holds, rather than put those executives up there to talk about an unknown future, they just aren't putting them up there at all.
Well, this is Tim Goodman of The Hollywood Reporter, and he did not waste words. He said they were chicken shit and that this was cowardly collusion by the networks to avoid talking with reporters. And he says, hey, you're losing an opportunity to change the discussion and to guide what people are talking about. And he thinks the fact that they just don't even want to go in front of reporters is an indication of how much trouble the networks really are. After he said that, I'm not linking the two, but more recently, Fox has said they may attend, but it's not clear yet if they will, at least not to me. I haven't seen an official confirmation of that. But most of the networks, at least if not all of them, are saying we really don't see any advantage to putting ourselves in front of journalists and having to defend ourselves, not right now. I guess they don't think they have a good story to tell. And of course, sometimes they do have a good story to tell. Last week, you teased me in suggesting that I wanted networks to report overnight ratings. They can report every ratings as far as I'm concerned, but I think networks are missing the boat when it comes to telling a good story about television. We talked about how Hollywood is making worldwide box office more and more of a story. You're seeing that in USA Today and other papers. They're covering the worldwide box office for movies like Fantastic Beasts because there's a story to tell and the information is out there. And I think networks are doing a really poor job of telling the story about how many people are watching their shows. Example, Westworld. Variety, a trade paper, the industry paper that should be on top of this. And I'm holding HBO to the fire on this, not Variety. Variety did a story interviewing Warner CEO Kevin Tsujihara about how excited he is for the first season of Westworld, right? They're talking about Westworld and what a big hit it is. And Variety reported in this story, they said, talking to the head of the studio about HBO and this show, they said, quote, it drew 3 million or more viewers across multiple platforms in its maiden season. And it has a way to go to match mega hit Game of Thrones. That epic occasionally brought HBO audiences of 8 million or more per show. That's in Variety. In fact, Westworld, according to HBO, averaged 11 million viewers in its first season. Game of Thrones is averaging 25 million viewers, and that's the entire season. That's not occasionally. That's what they averaged across all platforms for North America. And if they're not getting their word out to Variety about how big a hit Game of Thrones and Westworld is, that they can underreport by 65% the audience for Game of Thrones, practically the biggest set on TV, that's a big problem, right? They've got a really big problem about telling people how big their shows are. This Is Us on NBC, that show is steamrolling and growing into a big hit. What do they talk about? Just the overnights. They are not, I don't even know how big an audience this show is reaching. And it's really becoming a big, big show. It's growing multiple weeks into its run, just like Empire did a few years ago. That's a big problem. And one person wants to address that. That is the Group M Media Company. Their head of their company, Schwartz. Group M has been a leader in trying to get good measurements of TV ratings, and they are calling, like we have been, for new TV measurements across all screens. They want some metric that everybody can look at that says, who's watching this show? How do we define a viewing of a show if it's on streaming? Is it 30%, 40%? Yeah, you got to figure out the standards, you got to set it, and you got to start getting the word out about how many people are watching television, because that's what advertisers are paying for. You want them to pay money for these viewers. There's a story to tell. People are watching as much TV as ever, and you're not getting the word out. It's a big problem. Nielsen is working on their total audience measurement. These group people, Group M, are pushing for everybody to get together and come up with some standards so we can measure all the viewing going on. People are watching on their phones, they're watching on their laptops, they're streaming, they're buying on demand, they are watching TV, and you're not letting people know how many people are watching. And if even the industry isn't getting the word, you know the rest of America has no idea at all.
Well, and you're talking about Lyle Schwartz, who is the chief investment officer at Group M.
Thank you.
Yeah. And really, the reason I mentioned the whole Mummy trailer that was shown during the football game last night is I was at a restaurant and that's not counted. I mean, there were probably 200 people that all watching this thing. I don't know how you fix that problem, to be honest with you, because, you know, how are you going to count how many channels it was on and how many people were in restaurants and public places? I don't know how you solve that problem. But certainly these days you could do it through cable boxes and TiVos and devices. You can't do it for an audience sitting in front of those devices.
Well, you can. I mean, they do reporting by diary or thing. I think in a restaurant, you can have send people out to 500 restaurants and bars and measure the audiences and get a gruff idea of how many people are attending week by week and start to measure that. You know, there's ways to say, all right, we're getting an average of, you know, 47 people in this bar, 200 people in that bar. I mean, there's ways to measure it.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I just don't know that
it's hard work.
Yeah, no, it's and it's look, it's been a problem for since the evolution of television into streaming and over the top, and it remains so.
But that's a question of difficulty of capturing the numbers. Even when they have the numbers, like on Westworld, they're not getting the word out. If even Variety can underreport the Westworld audience and the Game of Thrones audience, that's the problem of HBO. They're dropping, and they say, oh, you know what? Our numbers aren't important as long as our subscribers, that's the only number that, blah, blah, blah. When they have something good to tell, they want everyone to know it. And if they've got 25 million people a week watching Game of Thrones, they should not have anybody thinking it's a third of that. That's a problem. So they need to get the word out. I thought Westworld was a flop. They're trying to say it's a hit. And every week there's numbers to share. You get the Live Plus 3, the Live Plus 7, get the word out. Get a good measurement and let the world know how many people are watching your shows. How can it be good to keep a secret? It's like reporting the Friday box office rather than the opening weekend box office. Why would you want to do that? The Friday number isn't as big. You know, it's a better story. We made this. Why would you want to tell just North American box office when you can say the movie made $800 million around the world? Surely that's a better story.
You know who would probably agree with you? Someone like Grant Tinker. Unfortunately, he passed away last week at the age of 90. He was the head of NBC during a very crucial period of time.
And he founded the Mary Tyler Moore Productions, the MTM Productions, his then wife, Mary Tyler Moore. He is a TV legend. I wish I'd met the guy and interviewed the guy. I grew up watching the TV ratings and the scheduling and what Brandon Tartikoff was doing. And it's kind of a sign that it took me a while to realize how important Grant Tinker was, because Brandon Tartikoff had the spotlight, and Grant Tinker, who was his boss, was happy with that. He was just a guy who let everybody do their job and do it really well. And he's famous for saying, first be best, then be first. He led with quality, and you can see his name on some of the best TV shows of all time. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Bob Newhart Show, Hill Street Blues. He kept Family Ties and Cheers on the air. He turned NBC around. Lou Grant, the White Shadow. I mean, the guy just is quality television, and he's just a legend. And he started so many careers and did such a great job and was liked by everyone and showed that, you know what, you can have a big profitable company by making good television. He also did the A-Team, and he also did,
Remington Steel.
Baywatch.
Yeah. And WKRP in Cincinnati, Miami Vice, Knight Rider. I mean, when you are that, when you were associated with that many hits.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, he probably knows a thing or two about television.
Well, he had a long, great career, and he was involved in a lot of hits, but above all is the quality of his best shows that really sticks with you. He really was helped make some of the best shows of all time happen. So he really is a TV legend.
Well, that brings us to our listener feedback. And I say feedback rather than email, because, of course, you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. And I am doing some research for David Knight, one of our listeners in the UK, on Brazil. Okay, so that will be coming next week. But
all right.
In the meantime, we actually have, I could actually play, there's a message we got here. This actually came in to our voicemail. Okay, Michael?
All right.
Hi, this message is for Michael Giltz. I'm calling from New York. I have a package that I received for him. I'm trying to get a hold of him, see if he's located at this number. Please give me a call back at 212-206. Again, that's 212.
Okay, so I'm not going to play that again.
You're just sharing that with me now?
It came in yesterday.
Oh, okay.
I just thought, okay, that's really funny. But okay, all jokes aside, we actually have a call from CJ Flynn, sometimes guest and listener of the show. And here's what he had to say.
Hi, I want to leave some overwhelming praise because I want to make sure that you are made aware that I appreciate that you leave plenty of clues when you're going to start talking about politics, because I've TiVo'd the election results from, when was that, last month or something, and I haven't been able to watch it yet, and I know that you appreciate things like TiVoing and not letting on what happened. So So please, if you're going to talk politics, please give advance warning. I should be able to finish all the shows I have to watch, West Wing and things like that, in the next 3 or 4 years. And so you can talk politics after that. Thank you very much.
And that was C.J. Flynn.
It's a sled.
It's a sled. Oh, don't. You've just ruined Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, thanks for writing in. Yeah, he's probably sick of hearing about politics just like we are. But it's a constant, and it does affect the industry, doesn't it?
It certainly has affected the cable news. That's for sure. That's all they talk about now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, but that wraps up the show for this week. And by the way, did I mention the name of the number that you could call to leave a voicemail?
No, please do.
888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You know, you can follow us on Twitter, too. Our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can search for our page on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and our page should come up. That information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to the show. And we do appreciate it when you subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and all of the podcast aggregators, whether it be iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories that we discussed on today's show can also be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, as well as all those ways to contact us. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Crazy Cat Forever.
Oh, I see. From the comic. Okay, yes, I get it. From the comic.
It's a great, great comic strip.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on that website, maybe head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his coverage of the entertainment industry, or head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com to find some of the latest and greatest books you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.